Kia ora everyone, I'm Dalkara and you're listening to Untamed Aotearoa, a podcast that celebrates the outdoor community and wilderness areas of New Zealand. In this show, I introduce you to a diverse range of inspiring New Zealanders who love the outdoors. We'll be covering themes linked to adventure, well-being, conservation and the professional outdoor scene in New Zealand.
Just live your dreams, be wild and ain't no need to explain them to me. You can run to the mountains or run to the sea. Just live your dreams, be wild and free. Well,
I know a guy who plays the blues. For episode 3, I chatted with Jess Hotter, a down-to-earth Kiwi woman who has been ripping it up on the Freeride World Tour. Jess has been on skis since before she could remember. Her parents met while working at Tūroa Ski Field on Mount Ruapehu. She grew up shredding the slopes of the same mountain, which you can see from her hometown of Oakuni. In 2019, she topped the Freeride World Qualifier Tour rankings and earned her place on the Freeride World Tour. She ended up on the podium in her second ever Freeride World Tour competition, the 2020 Kicking Horse Mountain Stop in Canada. She finished her first season ranked 4th overall, and won Rookie of the Year, and easily secured her spot in the Freeride World Tour 2021. In between racing seasons, Jess spent the last couple of winters back in New Zealand, working as a ski patroller and freeride coach at Triple Cone in Wanaka. I caught up with Jess a couple of weeks ago, just before she competed in Obsidian, the latest event to hit the snow scene in New Zealand. We chat about her passion for skiing, mountain culture and the freeride lifestyle, and also about risk, decision-making, and the psychology of freeride competitions.
Freeride is many things. Freeride is skiing with your mates and shredding all around the mountain and doing whatever makes you happy and having lots of fun with it. And freeride is also competing as well, which is looking at a face, picking a line down it, and skiing that line and being judged on it. So as far as like the competitive side of freeride, it's usually a face that's got cliffs in it, it's quite steep, it's quite technical terrain, and yeah, you ski a line through it and you're judged on 5 different criteria.
Man, it looks so crazy. It terrifies me.
Oh man, some of the stuff you do is way crazier.
It's quite interesting actually, you know, whatever you end up doing and being kind of a specialist at, it becomes really normal, and then you look at other people and think, what the hell are they doing? They must be mad. It's just a matter of perception.
Yeah. I look at the missions that you go on and I'm like, whoa, that's insane.
You know, just the other day I was ski touring and everyone expects me to be a good skier, but I'm actually really not. I'm pretty amateur. And I remember side slipping down an icy slope and just thinking of the video of you. I think it was posted by the Freeride World Tour where it's just a mashup of all these epic lines you're taking. And I was just like, oh man, I'm so embarrassed.
Oh, you know, like it's the thing as well, is, you know, you look at those videos and the conditions are pretty good usually. And you know, we've set up with like the best conditions, the best gear, but like when you go out ski touring and you go on like missions in the backcountry, it's not always going to be perfect like that. And there's so many people that they're like, oh, I'm not skiing that well, but it's like, oh man, the conditions are so variable most of the time. So
yeah, totally.
It's quite hard to ski it. And I've definitely had times like outside the ski area where I've been like, oh man, I'm skiing like crap. But I guess you got to remember that sometimes it's good conditions, sometimes it's questionable.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I guess something I'm kind of curious to talk to you about in a nutshell is what your kind of upbringing was like, you know, just painting a bit of a picture of where you lived and what you did in your free time around Oakuni.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up mostly in Oakuni. When I was quite a lot younger, so we actually lived in Oakuni up until the time that I was 3 years old. And my dad was working on the mountain and my mum was working at the primary school in Oakuni. And we actually moved to New Plymouth for 5 years and then came back to Oakuni when I was 8. And I guess, you know, we'd been doing like weekend trips and stuff when I was younger, but living at the mountain kind of resulted in me skiing a lot. When we got, you know, when we moved back to Owakuni, I spent as much time up the mountain as I really could. But yeah, like, I guess as a kid, I was always involved in like all kinds of different things. You know, my week was filled with like after school activities. I rode horses, swimming, piano, jazz. Like, I was very, very lucky to be able to do all of those things. And very fortunate that my parents put me into those programs to try different things out to see, I guess, to see if I'd be interested in them, you know, and everything always kind of led back to skiing. I was always the most stoked about skiing, and seeing like the passion that my parents had for it, and everybody else in the area, I guess, really, I guess, lit the fire as far as me and skiing. And yeah, I've just always really liked to be around the mountains. I've made my best friends on the mountain, and it's just my home, if that makes sense.
You must have been exposed to some pretty awesome role models and just like badass skiers on the field when you were quite young as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty cool. There was, I went into racing for a little bit when I was in school. And like, one of my coaches was this amazing, I think she was a slalom skier. She was really, really good though, and had a pretty big, large leg injury, and wasn't competing anymore. But like, having her as a coach to look up to was pretty cool. And yeah, I think the culture of skiing in the North Island is a little bit different from the South Island.
Interesting. And in what way?
I think more in the South Island, you have all these, you know, the legends from back in the day that we're here and that we're doing free ride. And being from the North Island, I wasn't really exposed to that, so I didn't really have those people to look up to.
Mm-hmm.
But I found other people to look up to, I guess, you know, like friends and things that they were doing, and I was trying to, you know, do the same thing. And you know, meeting people like Sam Lee when I was in high school, in my last year of high school, and I really looked up to him and his skiing and what he got up to, and that kind of helped lead me into the path of freeride, I guess.
Yeah, and did your school have a ski program or an outdoor ed program that involved, you know, had a ski academy or something like that?
Yeah, so we had a few different things. In my first 2 years of high school, we had a teacher there who was really, really stoked on skiing. I was kind of trying to make, I think he was trying to get the the thing that Mount Aspiring College had at the time, which was, you know, people would come to go to school there so they could be on the mountain and they could do this academy. And so I was doing race training in year 9 and 10 at school, and also doing skiing in PE. And later on in high school, I did outdoor, and we spent time on the mountain then for, yeah, outdoor PE. We also did clubs in the winter. So every Wednesday afternoon in the winter, in the winter term, we would pick a club, and one of them was ski and board, and you could go up the mountain. So
that's so cool, hey?
Yeah, I was getting up the mountain quite a bit.
Something it makes me think about is sort of, you know, in New Zealand, I feel like there's not as much money involved. This might be my assumption, but, you know, overseas and the big and the race industry and free ride kind of world tour, a lot of people come from like super wealthy backgrounds where you have to pay a lot to get to these massive resorts. Am I right in thinking in New Zealand it's a bit more low key, or is that just an assumption?
I think it's kind of a hard one to nail down, because in some areas, yes, definitely. But in others, because I think a lot of the people, say, in Europe, they were born in these mountain towns and they've grown up in these mountain towns. And so they've just naturally progressed into being on the mountain, and it's part of their culture a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So for New Zealand, I feel like it's less a part of our culture. You know how like rugby is a part of our culture?
Totally, yeah.
Skiing is less so. So it's not as easy to just lead people into skiing, because there's not all these clubs and there's not all that funding and the backing and all of that that really helps kids get involved in it. And if you're lucky enough to live near a mountain, you know, hopefully there is ways for kids to be able to get into that. And it was really cool, like when I was growing up, Rupe, who you know, made it easier for kids to give it a go, because they teamed up with the primary schools in the area and made it affordable for kids to be able to go up one day a week with their classroom in the winter so that they could try and learn to ski or board
mm-hmm.
and be able to appreciate the mountain that we had right there. But yeah, I think in some places, yes, there is a lot of money involved, but I think everybody has their struggles as far as access and money and all that kind of stuff in some way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And then I guess from the point when you were kind of in high school and just finishing school and trying to figure out what to do next, how did you get from there to where you are now? What was the process for you?
It was a pretty weird one. Not super weird, but I was actually going to be going to university straight after school. I had no idea what I wanted to study. It was somewhere along the lines of biology or geology or something along those lines. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, and I think my parents could see that I was struggling to decide. I didn't get into any of the halls of residence, so I would have had to go straight into a flatting situation, which was quite daunting for, you know, at 18 I was quite nervous about something like that, with knowing nobody in Wellington. So my parents actually suggested that maybe I should go and do a gap year.
Good parenting.
Yeah. Oh man, I can't believe they did. I look back at it, I'm like, man, my parents are cool. It was pretty cool. So they offered, you know, they kind of planted the seed. They more than kind of planted the seed. They said, do you want to go to Canada for a gap year? And I was like, well, let me decide. Because, you know, you've been in school for so many years and they've been drilling into you. You need to go to university. You need to go to university to get anywhere in life. And to have a massive change of decision, it took me a few days at least to kind of try and process it and be like, okay, what am I going to do? In the end, I just did decide to go to Canada, and I really haven't looked back since.
And what did you sort of do, the standard Kiwi thing of go to a ski resort town and get a random job and just spend as much time on the mountain as possible? Or
yeah, pretty much. I worked at Sunshine Village. We had have a family friend who is the operations manager at Sunshine, and so he hooked me up with a job. I did 2 days a week doing dispatch relief and then 3 days in sales and marketing. Yeah, like doing group services, so organising groups. Yeah, I had a great season. It was amazing. And I enjoyed the skiing so much. Came home back home to New Zealand after a year there. So I actually ended up spending a whole year there and did a summer as well. And yeah, came home, did a little bit more canoe guiding. And
awesome.
Yeah. Back in Okuni, it came home pretty poor, so I had to save some money and live with mum and dad again, which was, by the way, thanks mum and dad for putting up with me all the time. Yeah, and I think from there because the thing was, I wanted to go back to Canada. I desperately wanted to go back there. I wanted to go back and work and live there, but my visa had run out, so I needed to find a way to get sponsored. And the way I could see at the time was becoming a ski patroller. So I tried to get into ski patrolling. So I worked at Whakapapa in trail safety for a season and then did 3 seasons of patrol there. Unfortunately, by the time I'd become patrol, they wouldn't sponsor patrollers anymore in Canada. So
bummer.
Yeah. So that kind of, that one fell out the, you know, fell off the wagon. But
does that pretty I was just going to say, does that pretty much just leave the Canadian boyfriend option?
Oh, yeah, no, I had a Canadian boyfriend. He just didn't come to New Zealand in time. But, yeah. So, the Canadian boyfriend thing hasn't worked, obviously.
Not yet.
But, yeah, I did a couple seasons in Queenstown and then decided to start doing back-to-back winters again and went to Japan for a season, where I actually met a guy from, there was a crew, a few guys from around Squaw Valley, who were there skiing, and I met them while I was at work one night when I was waitressing, and they offered for me to come skiing with them, so I did. And one of them had been had previously been a freeride coach, and he suggested that I try and get into competing, which I'd considered before, but I wasn't really sure about it. But after that season, I decided to bite the bullet and go for it, and did my first competition that next winter in New Zealand.
Oh, I'm pretty. Is this the? This was kind of your first one, and did you win that one?
No.
What's no? Sorry, I'm getting mixed up. I don't know much about freeride skiing. Hey, I'd like follow it in like dribs and drabs. Basically, yeah, when awesome media comes out or you've done something really cool.
That's all good. The first competition, I actually crashed pretty spectacularly and hit my head on a rock. But it was all good because I got a wild card entry into the 4-star competition where I got third, which was awesome. And that set me up to be able to go overseas and compete and get into 4-star competitions in North America, which is what I did for the next 2 seasons over there.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, coming back to New Zealand and patrolling, working in ski shops. And now I've moved to the South Island for the winters here and I work in patrol at TC.
Yes, sweet. And I guess for people, you know, I don't fully understand the point system. So for people who don't really know, I guess, how the Freeride Tour works, how do you gain entry into it or into set competitions?
Okay, so this could get complicated and I will try and explain this as easy as possible. So basically in the qualifying events, you have to qualify to get into the Freeride World Tour.
Uh-huh.
So in the qualifying events, there is different stars. So 1, 2, 3, and 4-star competitions. And if you win, say, a 2-star, you get, I think it's 600 points. And if you win a 4-star, you get 2,500 points.
Wow.
So you want to be competing in the 4-star competitions to be able to get the maximum number of points to qualify for the Freeride World Tour. Every year, they take your top 3 results. So the results with the most points, they add the 3 together and that gives you a ranking. So they base the ranking on there's 2 regions. So it's North America, South America,
mm-hmm.
and Europe, Oceania, and Asia.
Based on where you come from or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both based on which country you're competing for. So it's New Zealand or, you know, you can actually choose if you're obviously a citizen from many countries. So they compare your points. You can compete in any competition around the world in the qualifiers as long as you can get into them. And that depends on your points as well. But they take every year so that ranking, what you've ended up with your 3 results together, your 3 highest results, puts you into the ranking. And then whoever's in first place in the female ski, one person from each region goes up to the Freeride World Tour.
Okay, and then so that gives you, it's weird, there are kind of some parallels between enduro, like mountain biking events.
Oh yeah.
But then the point systems are different, but I guess just this idea of lots of different events that can give you different points or feed into the larger series.
Yeah.
And then once you've gained entry into it, what does that mean exactly? It means it gives you license to compete, or does it mean you automatically get some funding, or do you have to then find that yourself?
So it gives you entrance into the Freeride World Tour for the next season. And once you're in the Freeride World Tour, there are certain things that are paid for within the tour. And I mean, some things are not as well. You pay for your own flights and anything in between, but usually the accommodation at the competition is covered. Some food. Not all food every time, but some food's covered. They give you a certain amount of money per drop-in. So when you drop in from the start gate, you receive a little bit of money to help pay for things like flights there and everything. So it's a pretty big step up as far as the media coverage and things like that on it. And some of the faces are really quite gnarly as well.
Man, it seems like it's quite a crazy contrast going from being like totally independent and aspiring to be on the Freeride World Tour to suddenly being on it. It's almost like you just like clicked your fingers and were there after a couple of events or something.
Yeah, no, it definitely was not like that.
No.
No, there was like 3 years. I think it took me 3 years to get onto the Freeride World Tour from starting qualifying events.
Okay, and throughout those 3 years, that was sort of your main goal, what you were working towards and training towards?
Yeah. That was, I guess, in the beginning, it was kind of to compare myself against, you know, not necessarily to compare myself. It was a good way for me to push myself and give myself a reason to push myself. I have goals to work towards. And it wasn't even necessarily like, I want to be on the tour. It was like, I want to get a podium finish this season kind of thing in North America. I definitely didn't ski to the best of my abilities in North America while I was there. But I did learn a lot while I was there, which was really cool. And yeah, I don't know. It's a pretty crazy process.
Were you sort of at this point, were you getting any support with training? Were you doing any cross training or stuff, you know, not on snow that was, you know, specifically meant to be helping your ski technique or just strength or endurance or anything like that?
Once I made it onto the New Zealand freeride team, they, Snow Sports NZ had a New Zealand freeride team. It gave me access to a trainer at the gym, at the Snow Sports NZ gym, and we get a certain number of sessions per week. So those were the kinds of things that kind of, you know, that I was working, like working on trying to stay as strong as possible. Honestly, most of the time that I was on the qualifiers, though, I was mostly focused on making enough money to be able to get overseas for the next season, which was the biggest focus. It was that and trying to stay fit as well.
Yeah, nice. Man, it's so interesting. It's like a completely foreign world to the world I've been in, but there are so many parallels with just, you know, drive for a particular sport or expedition or event and the motivation of just being outside with awesome friends and just being immersed and totally present in an activity.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like the freeride family is absolutely amazing. Everybody is so cool.
Yeah, how do you, like, what is it like? I have this perception, I don't know where it comes from, but of just the ski scene kind of just being full of people who are, like, super into adrenaline and, like, ski these crazy things and then come back and have massive parties and just, like, repeat it. But I don't know if that's just, like, from, you know, Red Bull YouTube videos or something.
Yeah, I think in the past there was a lot more of like the hard and fast lifestyle where it was like ski hard, party hard, rock up to the mountain hungover, do it all again, you know, kind of thing. But now because free ride is really starting to pick up and more people are becoming involved and it's, you know, becoming a sport that people are starting to fund, you know, there is some funding for it. I think quite a lot of people are actually, it's becoming more of a serious sport where it's, you train, you look after yourself, you try and eat right, you look after your body, you know, you're not necessarily sending at the bar after skiing every night kind of thing.
Yeah, interesting. So a lot more professional just on all levels, really.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the world of freeride, which is a pretty broad world because you've got competing, but you've also got the side where it's skiing around with a bunch of your mates, then sometimes there is still like crews that are down to party pretty hard, but I don't know, it's not everybody's cup of tea. I personally would rather feel good on the mountain the next day, because if I'm hungover, I don't ski well and I make excuses for myself. So yeah, so it's better not to be that way.
Yeah, totally. And if, just for your last season on the Freeride World Tour, in a nutshell, I'm just trying to get an idea of in my head, like what it looked like in terms of how often you were moving between different places. Was it that you were just pretty much a complete nomad for 4 months or something? Or how did it work? How did it look?
On the tour, it's a bit different on the qualifiers because usually you're based in one region. So you just base yourself out of somewhere and then you travel to the competitions and then go back home afterwards. But on the tour, it's definitely different. I ended up pretty nomadic this winter. I funnily enough, actually got a room in Verbier in Switzerland.
Nice.
Yeah, for the winter. Well, I got a bed in a room for the winter with some friends. And out of almost 3 months, I spent a grand total of 3 weeks there.
Wow, man, I hope you weren't paying much rent.
Verbier is not cheap. I ended up losing it because of the old COVID situation. I'd already paid my rent through till the end of winter and we lost a month and a half's rent in that, which was quite a lot of money. It's definitely more than you'll pay in Wanaka.
Yeah, especially Wanaka this season. It's pretty amazing how cheap things have been.
Yeah, not as cheap as what you'd expect, but definitely a little bit cheaper. Yeah. But yeah, I ended up, I think, first 2 weeks of the season was spent in Verbier, just to try and get my ski legs back. And then it was essentially straight onto Japan, 10 days, Canada for almost 3 weeks, and on the road the whole time. And then straight back to Switzerland for 2 days, then off to Andorra to the competition, back to Switzerland for 1 day, and then to Austria for the competition, and then came back to Switzerland, and they were tried to run the competition but just couldn't with the incoming virus. Everything shut down, so then that was time to leave.
Man, it's pretty cool that you got most of the season done before that happened.
Yeah.
What was one of your favourite spots on the Freeride World Tour, favourite locations?
Favourite locations would have been Kicking Horse and Austria.
Uh-huh. So Kicking Horse, that's Canada, right? For your runs, how many runs are you doing? How do you get to the top of them? Do you, you know, go up by lift and then walk? Do you get heli dropped into places? What?
Often you're walking.
Yeah. You're like, oh, I wish I got heli dropped into places.
Yeah.
That's the dream.
Yeah. It was pretty funny, actually, for the Austria comp, for Fieberbrunn in Austria, the snowboard boys got 2 heli bumps up to the top of the venue, and all the rest of us had to walk.
What?
We were so jealous. But it's because their competition didn't go ahead in Andorra, and so they had to do 2 runs in 1 day.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a pretty large feat to ask somebody to do that. So they had a heli bump in the morning to get them up there early because they wouldn't have had enough time with the lift opening. And then it was straight after their runs, they went back up again.
Mm-hmm.
So you're often walking from the top of a lift somewhere.
Yeah. Do you get to practice on it or do a run first? Or is it pretty much, you know, the videos that we see of you absolutely crushing some run where you're coming over a cliff at the end and landing and then coming straight into the finishing gates. Is that the... You know, how many times would you have done that run?
That's my first time.
As always, the first time. Man, that gives it a whole new level of just, man, you're so in the zone.
So you do what they call inspection. So the day before the competition, or hopefully a couple of days before or whatever works with the weather, you go out to the face and you sit at the bottom of it with binoculars and you stare at it for a really long time.
And what's going through your head at that point? Are you like ever completely psyched out, or you're kind of like completely just in the zone kind of?
It's kind of like a puzzle. So you've looked at photos and stuff. You actually get really high definition photos to look at a couple of days leading up to the competition. And after looking at the photos, you've kind of tried to put together a line, and then you go out to the face and you look at it and see if it's possible. On inspection day, all you're thinking about is, is my line fluid? Am I going to be able to turn between it? Is there room? How steep is it? Are there any features I need to be concerned about? And which angle am I taking off from something? We have forerunners that run down the venue so that you can compare, like it's like a point of reference. You can compare the size of them to the cliffs and everything. So you kind of have an idea on how big things are. And that's unbelievably important, actually, seeing the forerunners ski down. And then they give you an update on the snow conditions as well.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, because it's so hard to judge the scale of things when you don't have a point of reference.
Yeah, so you could be looking at something, you're like, oh yeah, I could hit that cliff. And it's funny, actually, because looking at Verbier this year at the finals venue, which we were hoping to ski on, that didn't happen. But earlier in the season, I actually went up the females, they call the Lady Beck, which is the smaller side. I went up there after having looked at the bottom and being like, okay, I'm going to look at this, and this cliff. And then I got up there and was like, hell no, that's ginormous, there's no way. It was pretty sobering going up there and actually looking at everything and being like, oh man, these cliffs are huge. Yeah, you know, and it's very important to see a forerunner going down that face.
Man, it's so much more calculated than I had expected. I mean, it makes total sense. It's just, it's weird how you have this perception of a sport just being, you know, like, I have a slight perception of people just like throwing themselves off mountains, just being like kind of crazy and just being like, man, it's going to be sweet. I've got this. Yeah. But it's more like a complete jigsaw puzzle that's so much more objective.
Yeah.
And I guess when you get really good at it, you're making these judgment calls without even realizing you're making them because you've got so much experience. It must almost happen automatically, like the little subtle things that you're doing.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, the whole process. Everybody does everything differently from each other. I tend to, as far as like my runs go, I sometimes decide at the top of my run what I'm going to do in the end, because you've got like a picture of the face in your head and all your features that you want to hit. But if something goes wrong, you need to have a backup plan.
Mm-hmm.
You then know that you've got something else you can hit that's off to the side or a couple of meters down, and you've got something else you can hit to try and bring your points back up, I guess, so you're not just skiing by features and not hitting them. Yeah, it's kind of, there's a lot of things going on with it, but everybody's looked at different options so many times that, you know, sometimes you make a decision last minute because you've got so many different options in your head, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And what's your mental game like before a race? Do you sort of have a typical routine you go through, or?
Not particularly. I guess the main thing is just making sure all your stuff's ready to go the night before, because you get up super early.
Yeah.
But recently I've been getting, like, I talk through lines quite a lot with other people, with friends, and Blake Marshall's really handy for that. We traveled around a lot together this season, and he helped me out quite a lot with that as well. But as far as like, yeah, you just feel sick in the morning before the competition.
Man, it makes me feel kind of sick and nervous just thinking about it.
Definitely don't. It's hard to eat. It's hard to eat in the morning, but you know you need to because you need the strength. But yeah, it's so weird.
And then when you're at the start line and you're kind of waiting for your go, you're just standing there, what normally goes on in your mind through that moment?
Usually you're just trying to visualize your line over and over and over again. So you're trying to, you know, closing your eyes and you're skiing yourself through your line. You're making sure everything is 100% ready to go, like all of your gear's ready to go. You've got your backpack sorted, you know, your GoPro's ready to go.
Is that part of the deal on the free ride tour? Does everybody has their GoPro mounted and that footage is all given to the tour basically?
Yeah.
Man, technology is amazing, because that is essentially what has allowed sports like that to become more professional, because that's how they get funding, right? They can create awesome content for people to watch, and that attracts sponsors.
Yeah. No, it's really cool. And also, you know, you look at, because you can look at people's GoPro runs from last year and watch them ski through a line. If it's a venue, if you're on a venue that they skied also the season before, then you can get ideas and pointers and things by watching other people's GoPro runs.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, which is super handy. It's kind of cheating a little bit, I guess, too, but, you know.
It's just something else in your toolbox, though, isn't it? Exactly. Everyone has the same options of resources to use and ways to prepare.
Yeah, so that really helped me with Kicking Horse. Unfortunately, my GoPro didn't work at Kicking Horse, so there is no footage of it.
That's such a bummer.
Yeah, they are great cameras, but sometimes with the cold, the batteries don't like it.
So Kicking Horse was the one. Was that your one event that you got gold in? You came first, didn't you, in your first free ride tour?
Yeah.
Man, that must have been such a sweet feeling.
It felt pretty amazing. The best part was getting to tell my mum and my dad and my little brother.
Your little brother must be like, yeah, my big sister's such a badass.
No, I think he just thinks I'm annoying most of the time.
Classic.
Yeah, but they were there at Kicking Horse for the competition. It was so nice to have them there.
Yeah, that's sweet. And in terms of like male and female, what is, you know, what percentage of the tour is male and what's female?
Ooh.
Not an exact number, but I'm just trying to get, I kind of make the assumption that there are more men, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, no, there definitely is. So, you know, how I said as far as the qualifying side of things, that the top female goes up into the tour from each region.
Yeah.
For the male ski, it's the top three from each region.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
And just because there's way more men competing in general.
Yeah. Yeah. And for the snowboard, it's the top male snowboarder from each region. So one, and one female snowboarder from each region as well. So the male ski definitely gets the most representation. I guess, you know, the Freeride World Tour is also, it's not only a sport, but it's also an entertainment thing as well. So people really enjoy watching the men ski because of the things they get up to. In the past, they've definitely, you know, gone a bit harder than other categories and everything. But I think at the moment, you know, people are really starting to catch up with them big time. But yeah, the representation, you know, is mostly male ski.
Is it something that's talked about? I mean, we're sort of coming through a stage now where there's this massive push for empowering women in the outdoors, especially in technical sports. Are there kind of people in the industry that are trying to shake things up and get more women involved and more coverage and stuff like that? Or is it just sort of evolving slowly?
Definitely. Like there is, you know, I mean, look at what the Freeride World Tour did this season, you know, equal prize money across the board, which is exactly what we needed to, I feel like it's what we needed to be respected as athletes in our sport more. And it shows, I think it shows in the way that everybody really pushed it this season. Yeah, I don't know. I guess like as an athlete, you know, you're on the tour and the male ski was the largest prize pool. But everybody's paying the same amount of money to be there. You know, everybody's done the same amount of hard work to be there. They have worked their butts off to make this happen. And for everybody to then get equal prize money was a really, really cool thing. It just showed that, you know, that there was that respect for everybody, which was super cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious on your opinion on this. Do you notice a difference in like with men and women? I'm not saying all men and women are the same, but I guess stereotypes around perception of risk and how I guess people deal with that. Do you notice much of a difference yourself, like when you're out with a bunch of guys or in an all girls group?
I think there definitely is a lot of differences as far as the way we look at risks, just through being of a different sex. Like I'm not sure about how the chemistry of the brain and hormones and everything works, but there is I don't really know how to describe it. There's a lot more planning and thinking and weighing up of consequences more in women, I think. But that might just be my own perception of what I, in my brain, what I'm comparing myself to, say, 20-year-old male skier who just absolutely sends it. And I don't know whether that comes from previous injuries and understanding how easy it is to get hurt and me weighing up risks because of that. Or I don't know whether it has something to do with that or whether it has something to do with like the chemistry, the different chemistries of our brains and who we are as people.
Yeah, and it's also age. You know, I haven't done a lot of research on it, but I do know that there's a difference, you know, with men and women, where I think a woman's brain is fully developed in terms of their perception of risk a lot earlier, you know, 23 or 24 years old, whereas a man, it's more like 27 to 30 years old. So that's a time people notice quite a big shift. It's pretty fascinating. I've noticed a massive, like, since I was 24 or 25, I noticed myself being way more afraid now, like way more afraid on steep snow, way more afraid in gnarly whitewater. And it's really interesting.
It's
like hard to know whether you should just embrace it or whether you want to kind of break those barriers and try and get back to where you were before.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I look at myself when I was trying to huck backflips when I was like 16 and being like, damn, I should have learned way more tricks at that age because I had zero fear.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, there was no problem. I would just go for it. And I wish I still felt that now. And for me to be going back to the park and trying to learn tricks, and, you know, at 27 is slightly terrifying.
Totally, yeah. Is there much talk about, I mean, obviously injuries are common. Deaths happen in the community as well. Is it something that's really on people's radar on a regular basis?
Like deaths or injuries? Or?
Just either. I guess I'm mostly thinking of, you know, breaking your back, of head injuries, of the more common but kind of extreme consequences of stuffing something up, really.
Yeah. I guess that's always in the back of your mind, but the whole rule of free ride and of competitive free ride is you're not skiing at, you're not trying to do things that you wouldn't be capable of. You have to be very aware of your limitations and what you have done in the past and what you are able to do and your strengths. And you have to play to that. The judges don't like being scared. They don't like us looking like we're going to kill ourselves.
Yeah.
So as far as like a competition.
It's such a funny thing to say, eh? The judges don't like us look. Yeah.
Yeah. But seriously, like that is what they say, is they don't like being scared. They don't want us to freak them out. You know, we need to look like we know exactly what we're doing and exactly where we're going. And that's what they want to see. But yeah, there is always going to be that risk there. But I think what helps me with it is that I've worked in ski patrol a little bit and I've seen how easy it is to get injured, but I've also seen what the body can put up with and not get injured. You know, there's people that slip over and hit their head on a rock and, you know, they're in a really bad way. You know, they come out with brain damage and things like that, or they pass away, you know, and it sucks. But sometimes it seems like the luck of the draw, because there's also people that tomahawk 100 meters down the mountain and walk away from it.
So yeah, it's crazy, hey? I think about that a lot. It almost just, it kind of seems unfair sometimes. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's all rolling the dice, though. And if you apply it to everything in life, you know, cars, vehicles are so dangerous. So many people have been in car accidents and hurt themselves. And if you think about it, it's people are whizzing around at ridiculous speeds in a vehicle. All it takes is one slip up.
It's pretty messed up that we're more afraid of recreational activities often than we are of driving, getting in the car.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is this season? Obviously, things are totally different with COVID. So there's this new event coming up in New Zealand. Do you want to just give us a quick rundown on what that is? It looks pretty awesome. It's quite creative, hey?
Oh, it's so creative. I'm super excited. Super nervous. So Winter Games obviously can't do the international competitions this season because we have no international athletes. So they've decided to put together this competition that they've called Obsidian. And by the way, that's a volcanic like rock that's glass-like, if anybody doesn't know that. it's this competition that's based on Kiwi athletes being in teams. So there's three teams. Each team has seven riders. It's got a mixture of females, skiers, snowboarders, males, skiers, snowboarders, everybody's involved. And there is four events, I think it is. So you've got a park event, so two park events. So you've got a Big Air and a Rail Jam. We've got a heli access free ride event and also a filming competition. So in a 10-day weather window, we will be competing in the park for 2 days at Cadrona, 1 day in the backcountry, and then every team was randomly drawn a ski area.
I looked at that. I saw that on your Instagram and you got triple crown, hey?
I know. Like, I was so lucky.
That's crazy. That that's such, man. And it was completely random.
Yeah, I think so. I was hoping for that too.
You must be so stoked on that. That's a massive advantage, eh?
Pumped. Absolutely pumped. It's great because I work there every day, so hopefully that's going to be a bit of an advantage. And a lot of the crew from Wanaka here have all grown up skiing TC and Cardies, so they'll have a really good idea on where to go as well. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. So does every person in the team do every event, or do you allocate certain team members to do certain things?
So everybody's kind of got their specialised areas. But you're essentially doing every competition, unless you want to step out of it for safety reasons. You know, if the jump is absolutely mag daddy, and you know, if it's super mag daddy, I might only straight air it. But yeah. You know, like I probably, you know, we're all competing and we're all being judged. So if you decide to sit out of it, then your team may not get points.
So you're better off doing it, but not doing a super amazing job, but just completing it because you're going to get more points for your team.
Yeah, and you never know what's going to happen, right? So, like, I could crash in my free ride run. And so then the next person, you know, whoever has crushed it that day, or, you know, anything could change. You know, you could have, like, Margot, who is amazing in the park. Like, maybe something goes wrong in the park and then you've got people like me who don't really ride park trying to do tricks and stuff. But you know, it could change on any given day depending on how your thing that you're the most comfortable with, you know, how that goes.
Yeah. And is one of the reasons you're nervous, is that because you've sort of got more pressure on your shoulders because you're part of the team and your results directly influence the other people that you're with? Or
yeah, I guess so. But I don't know, the way I see it at the moment is it's a really good chance to give something a go, whether you're good at it or not. And whatever happens, happens, because we all have good days and we all have bad days. So, you know, it would suck to, you know, to not do well in the field that you are most comfortable with, and that's, you know, what you compete in most, you know, usually. But realistically, if that happens, it's the luck of the draw. It's just how some things work.
Mm-hmm. And the video component of it, you've obviously, I think I had a quick look on the website actually, and it was saying, so you've got a professional videographer essentially tagged to your team.
Yeah.
And what is the deal with that video? What is the goal of it? How is it judged? Is it just like, here's an epic ski video? Like, who can make the coolest mashup of epic skiing and kind of showing the lifestyle and personalities in between it? Or
I think so. I'm not exactly sure about the judging criteria on the video, but I'd assume it's, you know, general impression kind of thing. I'm not sure who's judging the video thing. It might still be the same judges that are judging the other events.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what people come up with.
Yeah, that's super exciting. Man, it's interesting. Just that format makes me way more excited. I don't know why. It just sort of,
yeah.
It almost just creates drama. It turns it into this weird, like, reality TV show type thing.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty fun and it's going to be pretty hilarious. You know, if there's people up there at Cadrona watching us do park and you've got somebody who's doing, like, you know, triple corks and random crazy stuff like that, and you've got one person who's just straight airing. Like, it's going to be such a big mix of people. It's going to be really fun and that's really cool. Funny.
Yeah, and everyone has such different kind of strengths and personalities.
Yeah, yeah.
And people will be, what, anyone can come and watch it when it's actually happening.
Yeah, up at Cardies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And it's really cool because we'll get to see a lot of athletes are amazing at a lot of different things, and they are kind of dark horses when it comes to other sports. So I feel like there's going to be a lot of things being thrown down. It'll be pretty amazing.
That's cool, yeah. And the heli run, do you know the details of that? Is it, that's obviously a backcountry one. Is it a surprise?
I think so, yeah. I am not 100% sure about what the go is with that yet, but we find out more this week.
They probably just have all these locations and we'll pick the one that's the least icy or something.
Yeah, especially after the weather we've had recently, we're going to be praying for some snow.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so exciting. So, and at the moment you're hoping, I guess, I mean, depending on what happens with COVID, but to continue with the tour next season and head back overseas again?
Yeah. I really hope that goes ahead, but it's just going to be an interesting one with everybody's quarantine rules and everything.
Yeah, totally. And in terms of your own, I guess, how sustainable it is for you to keep up the lifestyle, both from, I guess, even from just a financial perspective, now that you're on the tour, have you been able to pick up any kind of cash sponsors or major gear sponsors that...
Yeah. So I'm currently with, Head, Head Skis. So I was actually with them previously when I was on the qualifying tour, when I was in North America. So they've been backing me for a while, which is super, super cool. And yeah, so I've got a contract with them.
Mm-hmm.
Mons Royale.
Yep, nice.
Good old Kiwi brand with the Merino, which is super cool. Real good for the mountains and all the sports that you end up doing.
Totally, yeah.
Especially, yeah, because I've kind of got into a little bit of biking recently.
I love biking. It's a slippery slope, Jess.
This is what I've heard. Everybody's been telling me it's one of those things that you start doing and then you get the biking bug and then what's skiing anymore?
Yeah, there's a few parallels though. Like when you talk about all the line choice and watching, you know, it just instantly transports me into the beach forest on like steep mountain bike tracks. And yeah, it's obviously a totally different but the same thing, speed and angles and yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Some of the stuff that people go down on bikes though, holy cow.
That makes me feel good. It's funny, you know, if I'm really scared in an outdoor sport, like the other day I had a really scary moment skiing, just actually walking into Access for a ski trip, and we got on this really precarious scrambly terrain where if we fell we would have died. I was like, almost wanted to cry. And the thing that often makes me feel better is like thinking about other people, you know, other people who are amazing. You're like, man, they must be really shitty at something else. It kind of makes you feel better.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that, you know, somebody might be a pro mountain biker, but put them on a skateboard and it's a disaster.
Totally. What are you scared of then?
Oh, there's so many things I'm scared of. Skateboards are one of them.
So you can hack off massive cliffs, but you're scared of skateboards.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. But as far as like sponsors as well, I'm with Peeps for my safety equipment.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so got Transceiver, Shovel Probe, and Backpack through those guys, which is super cool. And I'm with Snow Centre, one of the ski shops up in the North Island, up in Auckland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I used to work for the Manoa Kuni and yeah, still hanging out with them, which is cool.
Cool to stay loyal to the home brands.
Yeah. It's super nice, like, going and visiting every time. Everybody's really lovely. It's pretty cool to have everybody backing me, which is really, really lovely.
Kind of curious, like, right now you're kind of in the ski buzz. Do you have any, like, goals or aspirations to do other sorts of trips or, you know, like, long backcountry ski tours? I'm kind of thinking, like, you know, multi-week Alaskan trips or things that are more expedition-based or...?
Definitely. Definitely. At the moment, I am very focused on the competition side of things, but I want to start working, and actually I wanted to start doing that this spring, was start working on more backcountry skills.
Yeah.
Like using, you know, travelling with ropes on glaciers and practicing different skills like that. Glacier rescue and a little bit more climbing kind of stuff to try and hopefully move towards that direction in the future.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, it's something that fascinates me, and is super cool, but there's a lot of mental barriers I have to work through as well at the same time, which is fear of being cold overnight.
Man, it's interesting the things, hey, because that doesn't cross my mind at all, but then it's just totally what you've been exposed to and what you've got experience in.
Yeah, it's funny though, because, you know, I've had some camping experiences as a kid that really bothered me as far as the cold goes, and I didn't sleep, and I'm one, a person who's very focused on having a good night's sleep, and I love sleep, so it's like, you know, I want to try and make it so that I sleep well on those kinds of trips. That's important to me.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Oh, we should stay in touch. I'm always so keen on, it's interesting, my style of trips, I really like more mellow journeys, but on those trips, the cool thing about them is that you can have a group of people do them, and then you can do little side trips from the more mellow stuff. So you can kind of have people with quite different, you know, ski skill sets, and they can go on the same journey.
Yeah. That sounds cool.
Yeah. The best season, well, Alaska's pretty sweet, and it's kind of good with the seasons, because you can still, you know, into May and early June, you can still do those sorts of trips. It doesn't have to be in the peak of winter.
Yeah. Oh, that's super cool. I'd definitely be down to work towards more of that. Definitely. Buying gear as well. I've got to buy a lot of gear.
Yeah, it's expensive, eh?
Yeah. And then traveling with that as well is difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do you have any other shout-outs or things you're keen to add?
Just thanks to everybody who's had my back.
Yeah.
You all know who you are. Especially mum and dad and my brother and my sister. Those guys are awesome. And there's nothing that beats having family who share your passion and are really stoked on what you're doing.
That's so true. Hey, it's something that's really easy to take for granted. If having parents that fully understand the sport or the passion you have,
yeah,
and can get just probably more stoked than you when you do well.
Yeah, but you know, Dad, Mum, I do know when you hint that I should get something else behind me, like university. Yeah, we'll get there in the end, one day.
Oh, okay, that's classic.
I'll break my body now and use my brain later.
University is so overrated right now, Jess. Like, it's just example after example of people being super successful in life without university.
Yeah. I think when it comes down to it, it's having a drive to do something that you want to do, and if that's what you want to do, then you're going to do well at it.
Yeah, totally. And all the skills you learn, even now in these few years, it transfers into other stuff and the networks you have and all sorts.
Yeah. Like, I genuinely hope that in the future, when I'm all broken and beaten up, that I'll still be involved in the ski industry. And it's not only because of the skiing, it's because of the wonderful people around me.
Just live your dreams, be wild and ain't no need to explain them to me.
And that's it for episode 3. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jess Hotter. I think it's always really inspiring to see Kiwis doing amazingly well on the world stage. And I think our rugged terrain and conditions combined with the tight-knit mountain community in New Zealand make it a great training ground for those driven to compete and also to adventure on the world stage. It's going to be super exciting to see how the next few seasons evolve for Jess. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please tell your mates about it. You can find Untamed Aotearoa on all the main podcast apps.